There it is.
There we go. Okay. Come on in, people. We're going to start. You got about 45 seconds extra time this morning, so enjoy that. Next week, you can have a little biscuit or something because we're going to go now, all right? All right, let's pray, and then we're going to jump into Leviticus. Lord, thank you for the privilege to gather together this morning. Thank you for the gift of your word. Thank you for truth that we discover there. I pray you'd help us to understand your desire for worship this morning. I pray you'd help us to commit ourselves to worship you and you alone, and as you've designed. Lord, thank you for each one that's here this morning. Thank you for, again, just the privilege you've given us to study your word. We ask this all in your name. Amen. All right, Leviticus, we're in chapter 21. We're starting to talk about the priests and the holiness that God requires for the priests. So that's where we are. Chapter 21 and most of chapter 22 are that very thing where Moses takes this chapter and almost two chapters to really set apart, even though the regular Israelite was commanded to live a separate life. Beyond that, then, even the priests were held to an even higher standard of holiness. And so that's what chapter 21 and 20, most of 22 are about, is the standard of holiness for the priests. It's important to recognize, first of all, that priests all are descended from the line of Aaron. That's where the priests come from. They're not, every Levite isn't a priest. Other Levites were their other functions they served. Only those descended from Aaron were actually the priests for Israel. Everyone else was a Levite, taken for service for God, but not in the sense of actually doing priests. So what we have in mind here in chapter 21 and most of chapter 22 are those who were the ones who were actually the ones who were doing the worship, the ones who were actually offering the sacrifice. They're sprinkling blood. There is in mind even some distinction for the high priest, the one who enters behind the veil and goes into the Holy of Holies. He's even held to a higher standard than even the regular priests were. So that's what's going on here. And as he first starts off, the first requirement is that the high priest or the priest cannot touch any dead thing. We talked about this a little bit last time that I taught Sunday school, which was about 2 weeks ago. So he can't touch anything dead, except he can participate in or be a part of the funeral ritual or getting the body prepared for immediate family. He could do that. So that was the one caveat for that. But he couldn't do it for any kind of extended family or any kind of even a friend. He couldn't do that. The next section of the requirement for the priest is how he was to look differently than the priest, or look different than the priests of the other false religions that were around the area. He couldn't shave. What's it say? He says he shouldn't make bald patches on his head, shave the edges of his beard, or make any cuts on their body. So he wasn't supposed to do that. So there was a distinction for even how he was to look, and he was supposed to look different. He wasn't supposed to look like the priests for the false gods in the land. He was supposed to look different. He was supposed to be separate and distinct from them. The next section is who he can marry, really. It's he should not marry a divorced woman or anyone who he's to marry. In fact, he'll go on later in the chapter over in verse, where is it? Over verse 14. He'll actually give more definition to the one that a priest can marry. And it can't be, he should take a virgin, not a widow, not a divorced woman, or one who's been defiled or a prostitute. He should not marry one of these, because even his offspring, the offspring of the priest, was supposed to be a protected race. Not race, that's not what I'm looking for. Line, that's what I'm looking for, a protected line. So there would be purity in that line is what is being looked for there. So he's supposed to do that. He was supposed to... when he was, this is what I'm still working on. It says verse 12, after the high priest, and the verse 11 starts talking about the high priest, the one who's been anointed with oil, the one who will wear the garments, the one who will go into the Holy of Holies. That one specifically shall not let the hair hang loose on his head. That's he would tie his hair up, I guess, and that's probably so that none of his hair would fall on the mercy seat or fall where and defile the Holy of Holies, because he's the one going into the veil. So I can understand that. But then it actually says, he shall not go out of the sanctuary, lest he profane the sanctuary of his God. I'm not exactly sure what that means yet. I've been working on that one a little bit. Not exactly sure what it means, whether it's on the Day of Atonement, he can't go out of the sanctuary and back in. You know, he can't take a coffee break. You know, he can't reach his contractual obligation. Say, hey, it's time for a break, kids. I gotta take my break. I don't know what's going on there. I'm still working on that one. So, but suffice it to say, I'm not going to spend a whole lot more time on that because it affects none of us here. None of us here will ever be the high priest of Israel. None of us here will ever have to worry about what it means to go out of the sanctuary. We don't have to worry about that. The key, the truth, the thing that the principle we need to take with us is that we are to be separate. We are to be different. We are to be distinct and not look like everyone around us, not act like everyone around us, and be separate. That's the whole call here. Then, like I said, he reemphasizes the one that the high priest would marry. Again, that is to protect the line of the high priest, the line of the priest. Then he goes on and he lists some disqualifying disabilities that if you are disabled in this way, you cannot serve as a priest. Now, it doesn't, the list is pretty significant. If you don't have an arm, you're missing a limb. If you've got a blemish, I would be in sad shape. I would, if I had been born from the line of Aaron, I would have been disqualified nearly immediately. I don't have one blemish. I got about 10 billion blemishes on my skin. In fact, the kids play dot to dot. No, they don't really do that. You can draw a lot of pictures of all the freckles on my skin. But anybody who's blemished, I love. What's it say about his face? There was something he said. Oh, mutilated face. So there's another disqualification for me. A limb too long. There's a whole list of things that disqualified. Now, it's important that disqualified that priest from serving as a priest. It didn't get him kicked out of his house. It didn't mean, well, if you're that person, you can't even be a part of, you know, throw him out. Put them outside so they'll starve to death and die. That's not what's going on here. They could actually eat all the priest's food. They could do anything else that a priest did, except they could not offer the actual sacrifice. They couldn't be high priest. They couldn't serve as a priest, but they still could live in their house. They could still do those kinds of things, but they couldn't serve as a priest. There is a prohibition against those who are lame and those who are blind. Later on, as David is going in to take the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites, he's going to go take that. And the Jebusites say to him, oh, let's put our lame and our blind people and we'll protect it with that, because they thought David was such an insignificant person that they could protect their city with lame people and blind people. And so as David then takes the city and takes the hill, takes the mountain, he says, no one lame or blind will ever serve as priest here on this mountain. That actually got morphed into, by the time we hit New Testament times, that no one lame and no one blind could actually enter into the temple proper area. That's why in Acts chapter 4, the lame guy, the lame man is sitting at the gate, not in the temple, because the lame couldn't go in there based on that. But that is not a Levitical prohibition. The prohibition against lame and blind people actually going into where the temple is, into the courtyard, that is not a Levitical. That's not from Leviticus. That's from David's statement as he's taking Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and that morphed into a prohibition against anyone lame and anyone blind going into that place. That is not, if you were just a lame or blind person, that did not prohibit you from entering into the courtyard. It didn't stop you from doing that. It stopped you as a priest from actually offering sacrifice in there, but that's the only limitation that it offered for you. So, that's a little bit of history. You got that for free. So we have the disqualifying diseases or disabilities, if you will. And then he moves away from the people themselves to the things they do, the things they eat, the things they touch. And he moves into the chapter 22 is a section really regarding that. They shouldn't do anything that's going to profane the name of the Lord. That's the key for them, is they don't do anything to profane the name. He says they don't touch anything that is holy. And the reason, and he defines what he means by that. You don't use anything that's holy when you are unclean. When you are unclean, you don't then use something that's dedicated, because you're profaning. And if you do that, he says, you'll be cut off from the people. Not that you'll be stoned to death, not that you'll be killed, but that you'll be cut off. In other words, you'll be sent away from the people, not be able to participate in the congregational worship of God as a Jew. And he lists things that make unclean and those limits. I'm not reading all of those. You can read that for yourself. He also lists who can eat the priest's portion and who can't eat the priest's portions. If you're a priest, the way you got your stuff, remember you weren't supposed to have your own land, your own property, your own stuff. The way you were cared for, the way you were provided for, was through the sacrifices of the people. That is how you got your food. That's how you got your stuff. And so if you were a priest, that's what you were supposed to eat. But if you had guests in your house who weren't priests, you weren't supposed to feed them that stuff. If you had, for instance, if I'm a priest and I have Dave Crandall and his family over, right? I wasn't supposed to pull out the stuff that was dedicated to God, the stuff that had been offered as sacrifice. I was not supposed to pull that out. Hey, I got a whole leg of lamb here. We're never going to eat this. Come on over. Let's have dinner. And we would have that together. That would be profaning. Not because he's Dave, I get that, but because he's not a priest, and I would be a priest. That would be what's going on there. So if you had a friend over, if you had a stranger that was staying with you for a while, you know, a foreign stranger is talked about here that was staying. I think that's actually a fourth class of people, somebody who's traveling through but staying with you as a foreigner. You could not feed them that food. But if you had a slave, if you bought a slave who was not a Jew, they could eat that. They could eat that because they were considered part of your household. So anyone that was part of your household could eat, but anyone not part of your household or anyone not a priest could not eat that food. So if you had a daughter and your daughter married, this would be bad on Easter when you had people come together for Easter. If you had a daughter who married a non-priest, you had a daughter marry a non-priest, when she came to your house, she couldn't eat the food that was dedicated to the Lord. But if she was widowed and came back to live with you, or she was put away by her husband and came back to live with you, then she's under your authority again, and she could eat that food. So that's how all that worked. Again, I'm running through this rather quickly because none of us are ever going to have this situation approach or present itself to us. It's just not going to happen. Yeah, Ron. Okay. Yeah. Because of something like that. He's the anointed. Got it. So Ron's answering the question. I said I didn't think go out of the sanctuary. He says when one of his family members dies, he's supposed to stay at it. I think you kind of get that a little bit. Remember when, have we got there yet? Maybe I read this. I don't know if it's in my head, but a death happens. Yeah, it was when Nadab and Abihu died. It was when they offered the strange fire, remember? And Aaron is mourning, or Aaron doesn't eat the food, and Moses gets on him, and Moses said, why aren't you eating the food? You're supposed to be, and Aaron says, hey, wait a second, I haven't even cried, I haven't mourned publicly, I haven't done anything, but I'm not hungry, I don't want to eat. I don't think it's asking God too much to let me not eat. So there was even a prohibition for the high priest against mourning loss, because in some sense they're profaning or defaming God for what he's doing even in that. So that does make total sense. Wow, I agreed with Ron. Let's just go home now, shall we? Anyway, so that's the priest. That's what's going on with them. The key here is God wanted the priests and the priesthood to be different than everything else around them. That's what he was calling them to. They couldn't just worship the way they wanted to worship. They needed to worship and lead in worship the way God wanted that to happen. So that's the key point here in chapter 21 and most of chapter 22. When we get to chapter 22, verse 17, we switch gears a little bit. It's still for the priest. Still for the priest, but it's regarding acceptable offerings. It's regarding what is an acceptable offering. And so we are going to spend a little time here. I'm actually going to read this section, and then we'll spend a little bit of time here because of Malachi. So we're gonna do that, and then we're actually gonna look at Malachi just a little bit. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons and all the people of Israel, and say to them, when any one of the house of Israel or any sojourner in Israel presents a burnt offering as his offering for any of their vows or freewill offerings that they offer to the Lord, if it is to be accepted for you, it shall be a male without blemish of the bulls or the sheep or the goats. You shall not offer anything that has a blemish, for it will not be acceptable for you. When anyone offers a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord to fulfill a vow or as a freewill offering from the herd or the flock, to be accepted, it must be perfect. There shall be no blemish in it. Animals blind or disabled or mutilated or having a discharge or an itch or scabs, you shall not offer to the Lord or give them to the Lord as food offering on the as a food offering on the altar. You may present a bull or a lamb that has a part too, you may present a bull or a lamb that has a part too long or too short for a freewill offering, but for a vow offering, it cannot be accepted." And he goes on to talk about some other disqualifying reasons that you can't offer. So he goes, and the idea here is you bring, hey, nice shirt, Raj, you bring your best. You bring what is the best that you have. You don't bring seconds to God. You don't bring, hey, this lamb, we would never eat this thing. This is nasty. I know. Let's use it for a sacrifice. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to give your best. You're supposed to give your best. This is significant when you get to the book of Malachi. Because the book of Malachi comes at the end of the Old Testament. It comes after the Babylonian captivity. Malachi is writing in about 430 or so BC. So this is actually nearly 200 years after the Babylonian captivity began. So this is post-Babylon. Yeah, Chris? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It wasn't. You had to find them. You had to keep them prepared. Yeah. That's Chris said. So this it took effort to get to make sure you had this. That's why you have by the time we hit first century, you have groups of shepherds who are raising blemishless animals. That you didn't have to actually raise your own blemishless animal. You could actually go buy a blemishless animal. In fact, it made sense to actually buy one from them because if you took one to them, what was likely is going to happen is the priest was going to examine it and find something and say, "Oh, you can't use this one. We'll take it off your hands. You need to go buy one from us." You'd go buy one from us, and then they would take the one you brought and put it into their herd. So the next guy would buy the one that you just brought that they said was no good. The priesthood, by the time you hit first century Israel, the priesthood was very, very corrupt. But by the time you hit Malachi, the priesthood is very corrupt because this is a big deal for the priests. They were not supposed to. Yet look what God says, condemns really Israel with after they've already gotten through the Babylonian captivity, after there have been great changes made. He says this to them. Verse chapter 1, verse 6, "A son honors his father and a servant his master. If then I am the father, where is my honor? If I am the master, where is my fear, says the Lord of hosts, O priests who despise my name? But you say, how have we despised your name? And he says, by offering polluted food on my altar. But you say, how have we polluted you? By saying the Lord's table may be despised when you offer blind animals in sacrifice. Is that not evil? When you offer those that are lame or sick, is that not evil? Present that to your governor and see if he will accept or show you favor, says the Lord of hosts. And now entreat the favor of God that he may be gracious to us with such a gift from your hand. Will he show you any? Will he show favor to any of you, says the Lord of hosts? And this is the thing. Oh, that there was one among you who would shut the doors that you might not kindle fire on my altar in vain. I have no pleasure in you. God says, I would rather no offering be offered. I'd rather no offering be offered than you offer me junk. I mean, these are God's words. Oh, that one person would just shut the door so no one could get into the temple to offer profane stuff. He would rather have nothing because he despises that kind of second best offering. He despises that. When I was a kid growing up, we grew up in a church that had didn't have the same kind of missions philosophy we had. And so we had back on the board, we had like, I think 300 missionaries that our church supported. You had a little button you could push and it'd light up where they were. And you, I can remember the lights. I have no idea what any of the names were. I can't remember a single name of one of our missionaries. I can remember one because their son used to go to church here, Terry Chastain. His dad was a missionary someplace. I wish I could tell you where. I don't have any idea where he was because he was one of our 300 missionaries. And really, we didn't know him very well. But we would do, yearly, we would do these big mission support drives, you know, where you would do stuff. Well, my mom tells this story that our pastor's wife said, and here's what I'm doing. After I use my tea bags, I'm putting them in back in plastic, and I'm bringing those. I'm giving all my used tea bags to our missionaries. What a gift. What a gift. And I, you know what? Most of you just, oh. And yet, we offer the same kind of stuff to God, don't we? Don't we? Our worship oftentimes is second best, second thought, second best worship. So before you chastise that pastor's wife too much, let's consider how we're worshiping God as well. He wants our best. That's a principle that applies not just to the priests and just to Israel. That's a principle that applies to all of us. Larry?
You know, as we read through the Old Testament, we see where God talks about weights and measures and dishonesty and the deception and everything. I really think that that really, really, really applies to this part.
Absolutely. 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 That is clear. That's a good point. That's a clear principle that applies across the board, especially here. God, I mean, when you're dealing with your friend, your neighbor, you're supposed to be honest. And when you're dealing with God, you should be equally so. And you can pull something over on your friend's eye, over on your friend. You can't do that with God. You might say, well, that's Old Testament, Brian. That's Old Testament. That's not how God deals with this church today. And I would introduce you to Ananias and Sapphira. I want to ask you to ask them the question or make that statement to them. That, but it won't affect the church. Oh, yes, it will. God makes it real clear that when you offer less than what you say you're giving, he dealt rather harshly with that, didn't he? If you don't know the story, read Acts chapter 5. We just went through it when Mike was preaching. Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias, they sell a group of land, they sell a parcel of land, and to look good, they determine we're going to say we're going to give this much. We're going to say it's all we got, but we're going to hold some back for ourselves. They go in. Ananias comes in first. He says, here's everything. And Peter says, why have you lied? Why have you lied? And boom, he's dead. As they're carrying him out, covered in a cloth, his wife Sapphira walks in, says the same thing. She's dead. What was going on there? They offered less than everything. And it wasn't that God needed everything. It's they said they were giving everything. They lied. They held back for themselves. And that's exactly the point. We are not to hold back in worship. We're supposed to worship God fully, completely, and we're to give our best in worship. That is a principle that applies across the board in every generation, in every age, and for all of us here, it applies. So, God would rather have no worship at all from you than worship that's holding back. That's what he says. In Amos is a pre-exile prophet. But Amos actually says to the people who are worshiping because they really enjoy the feasts. And maybe, you know, I think sometimes that's why we worship. We really love the feeling of worship. We love being in that feeling, and we do that because it makes us feel good. Amos, God speaking through Amos, says, I despise your feast days. Basically, he's telling them, you've stolen the feast days away from me and made them all about glutting yourself, made them all about you. Again, it's an idea that you're not worshiping the way I want you to worship me. It's not what it's all about. It's not about your feeling. It's about worshiping God and proclaiming him and lifting him up and magnifying him the way he ought to be worshiped. I think that's a principle that we can clearly take from the book of Leviticus and apply it directly to our own lives today. So that's acceptable offerings. Catherine? That's true. And like Catherine said, worship is not just done on Sunday mornings. We worship God in every area of our life all the time. We're really good, especially in 21st century America, we're really good at compartmentalizing. We have the secular, which we would say is Monday through Saturday, and then we have the sacred, which is Sunday. You maybe even thought this, well, you shouldn't lie on Sunday. Well, no, you shouldn't lie any day of the week, you know? Oh, I shouldn't say something about the pastor on Sunday, you know. Well, no, please don't say anything bad about us at all. If you're going to say something bad to us, say something bad about us, say it to us so we can change if we need to change. Don't say it about it to somebody else, but I shouldn't say it on Sunday. No, you shouldn't do it any day of the week. We shouldn't. I said in a sermon a year and a half, 2 years ago, there's no such thing as secular for a believer. There's no such thing as secular. We are always worshiping God in every area of our life, in every aspect. There is no secular. So you got me preaching, dear. You got to stop that. See, she comes in and I start preaching. I don't know what the deal is there. She's turning the pages. That's what she does. She turns the page. So any other comments, questions, statements about the acceptable sacrifice? I'll let you determine. Whether you're offering acceptable or unacceptable sacrifice. I won't do that for you. Nor should you do that for me. That's between you and God. The next section, and we're getting ready. We're getting closer to wrapping up Leviticus. Yay. And we've really flown. Look what we've done today. Look what we've done. We have gone through almost two full chapters. We're getting ready to hit our third chapter. I don't know what that is, Roger, but you're going to have to stop that because people are now distracted. They're looking, oh, that looks like Brazil. That's a big Jesus, I'll tell you that right now. All right, feast. He's now going to actually walk again through the feast. We're getting to the end, and he's going to reestablish or revisit the feast. He did this earlier in the book, and now he's going to do it again here as we approach the end of the book. So we're getting ready for the summary statements. So he starts off with, I call this feasts and worship. If you're following along on the notes that you may have, you've had them for about 3 months now, but if you're following along with those, this is Roman numeral 7. It is feasts and worship. It goes from chapter 23, verse 1, all the way to chapter 24, verse 9. So really we're moving our way toward the end of the book. He reminds him, he says, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, these are the appointed feasts of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations. They are my appointed feasts. So these are the ones that God says, you will do these feasts. These are the feasts you will do. And the first one, so that was the introduction in verses 1 and 2. The Sabbath is first. Chapter 23, verse 3, the Sabbath is first. 6 days work shall be done, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath, a solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwelling places. So that is number one listed is the Sabbath. It is the big deal for them. It is the one that they were supposed to do to work. Now, that's what it said. That's what the law says. And there are a couple earlier on. There's no kindling of fire. We already read that. No kindling of fire on the Sabbath. There are a couple other clear prohibitions that are considered work on the Sabbath. By the time we get to first century, there are hundreds of definitions of work on the Sabbath. Where did that come from? Where did that come from? It came from a desire to protect the law from being broken. Really, it started in the Babylonian captivity. That's where it really started. Up until the Babylonian captivity, really, Israel didn't care if they broke the law. Seriously? Yeah, really, Israel didn't care if they broke the law. It's so bad, again, I've told you the story, but when Josiah becomes king, he is a reformer kind of king, and he says we need to get back to good worship. We need to get back to right worship. So he says, you know what? The temple's broken down. We need to fix this temple. We need to rebuild it. We need to make it what it used to be. Restore some glory to it. So he has some workers go in, and they break out this area. They go in and they find this scroll thing, and they pull it out and they say, "Why is this?" And Josiah says, "I don't know. What is this?" So the priests look at it and they say, "Oh, it's the law. It's the law." And Josiah says, "We probably ought to read that, don't you think?" And the priests say, "Yeah, we probably should." So he gathers everybody together and has the law read publicly. And at the end of the reading of the public law, the people are smitten with grief, because they hadn't kept the law. You know, Josiah is like five kings from the end in the history of Israel, in the history of Judah. He's five kings from the end. And the last three are only puppet kings that Nebuchadnezzar sticks in place. Jehoiachin, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah, they're all just puppet kings. So you've gone all the way through there, and you have at the fifth to last king, he's saying, "What is this law thing?" So, yeah, Israel didn't really care to keep the law. But going into captivity, one thing they got right was, if we don't keep this law, this is a bad thing for us. If we want to be in the land, we've got to keep the law. So we got to make sure we protect the law. So they came up with this thing called the Mishnah. The Torah is the law. The Mishnah is this thing of 613 laws around the law that says we don't, I think a lot of times when we as Baptists look at that, we as non-Jews look at that, we say, "That's a terrible thing. How dare you?" And you've done it. You've done it and haven't felt badly about it. Let me give you an example of how you've done it and not felt badly about it. I'll bet when your kids were small, you told them, "Don't play in the street," right? You said, "Don't play in the street." But because you told them, "Don't play in the street," you probably had on your driveway one of those expansion joints about 15 feet back from the street. And I'll bet you told him, "Don't even go past that expansion joint right there." Why'd you do that? Because the street was the prohibition, but you didn't want to even get close to the street. Was that a bad thing you did? Did you lie to him? Did you make an extra step of what you were protecting the law that, and if they violated, I know I can tell you this for sure, if my kids violated the expansion joint before the street, they were disciplined for it. The trouble is, I was in charge and could make that law. The priests weren't. The Pharisees weren't in charge. They couldn't make the law. You know, when I'm making law, I can do that. When God makes a law, we can't expand His law. His law is perfect. His law doesn't need our help. And oftentimes, it's when we try to give Him help that we get ourselves in trouble. Look at Eve. What are you saying, Brian? I'm saying, well, remember in Adam and Eve, God told Adam, "Don't eat the fruit, because the day you eat of it, you will surely die." And yet somehow, in just a little bit of time, when Satan asks Eve, "Has God said you can't eat the fruit?" Eve says, "We can't eat it, and we can't touch it. Because if we do, we die." Where did "not touch it" come from? Where did that happen? I would not be surprised if Adam, trying to be a good leader, said, "You know what, Eve? We're not supposed to eat that fruit, so let's not even touch it."
It's an expansion joint.
It's an expansion joint, yeah. And you know what? It does make sense. If you never touch the fruit, it's going to be really hard to eat it. right? You know, it's going to be really hard to eat the fruit that way. So you can see the point, but it was that misuse of the law, I think, that really let Eve think, well, God's really kind of stingy, isn't he? And when she reached up and touched it and she didn't die, hey, we can touch it. Then we eat it. So anyway, that's you get that for free too. So originally the Sabbath was not nearly as restrictive as it was in Jesus' day. By the time you get to Jesus' day, there are hundreds of laws written around the Sabbath about things you couldn't do on the Sabbath and about definitions of work on the Sabbath. That's why Jesus has some of the issues that he has with the Pharisees. Remember, he heals the guy's withered hand on the Sabbath, and this is what you've done. You've healed. You've healed on the Sabbath. And he says, is it good to do good on the Sabbath or evil? Well, do good on the Sabbath. Well, do you think healing a guy's hand is a good thing to do? Yeah, okay, then I don't think I violated the Sabbath then. That's kind of what's going on there. And Jesus could do that because he's not actually violating God's law. It wasn't God's law he was violating. It was, in their mind, he was violating the law written around the law is what he may have violated. I don't think he even did that. So anyway. So the Sabbath is first. The Sabbath is a big deal. Next, and it's almost a chronological kind of giving of these things. Sabbath is first because it was given first. It was the one that had come. The next is Passover. Passover was the celebration, the commemoration of them coming out of Egypt. And it's listed here about how they're supposed to keep the Passover. And again, it's a holy convocation. Verse 8, a holy convocation, you shall not do any ordinary work on it. And then you have the Feast of First Fruits. And again, these are now going to be chronological feasts throughout the year. The Jews have two kinds of calendars. They have a civil calendar, which starts on Rosh Hashanah, right? That's the Jewish New Year. But they have a ritual or a feast calendar that starts with Passover. So you have two calendars running with each other. So first feast, what starts the festival calendar is Passover. What starts the civil calendar is Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah is in September. Passover is in March or April, somewhere around there. So they got these two things going on. So if you ask, well, certainly doesn't look like, to me, if I do the math, it doesn't look like Passover is the first feast. But it looks like Passover is kind of halfway through. But it, as far as the Jewish festival calendar goes, Passover is number one. Passover is first. And then you have first fruits, which is actually a part of, isn't that right, Ron? Is first fruits a part of Passover? Unleavened bread is a part of Passover, right?
Well, yeah. Passover really is just a feast.
Yeah.
I mean, the meal.
Right. Okay. So Passover is a term that indicates all three of the spring feasts. So you have Sabbath, Passover, first fruits. First fruits was when it wasn't the first harvest. It was the first time you could actually eat something from the crop. So it was like the very first blueberries. You couldn't go out to the blueberry patch and get those and eat those. You were supposed to actually save those. Oh, it was hard to be a Jew. Say again?
Blueberries would be around October. That would be...
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that. So, anyway, the first fruits wasn't the first harvest. First fruits was the very first time you could get anything from that plant. That was to be dedicated to God. So it was early. The Feast of Weeks, I think that's Pentecost in the New Testament. When you think Feast of Weeks, think Pentecost. It's 50 days. That's what Pentecost means, 50 days. It comes after the thing. And again, it is a. These are all Sabbaths. These are all special convocations. These are all things that everyone would do in Israel. Then you have the Feast of Trumpets. That was a calling together of people. You have the Day of Atonement. I'm flying. I know I am, but I wanted to get through this chapter if possible. The Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement is a big day. It is a big day in Israel. It's today it's called Yom Kippur. It is the day when the atonement was made, covering was made for the people. It comes into really strong play when you get to the book of Hebrews, and the Day of Atonement is played against Christ's propitiation, where the Day of Atonement was done. If it had been done every year, it had been done thousands of times, but Christ entered once for all. And even the Jew had to recognize that the perpetual sacrifice, the perpetual Day of Atonement, was not accomplishing really anything because it had to be done over and over and over again. Yet Jesus entered once for all and never again. So clearly, even he points to that, that the Day of Atonement actually clearly pointed to the need for and the coming propitiatory sacrifice of Jesus that he would give on the cross, offering his own blood, giving his own self. That's the Day of Atonement. It's huge. It's a big one. And then you have the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's when every three of these feasts, every Jewish male had to come to Israel, had to come to Jerusalem, 20 years and older, had to come to Jerusalem and be there for that feast. That was a required, those were required convocations, required times when they would come together. Every male 20 years and older had to come to Jerusalem for that, or wherever the presence of God was. So when the tabernacle was not in Jerusalem, they would go to like Shiloh or wherever the tabernacle was at that point, they would all have to go to that place to celebrate those things. There is significance in every one of these. Ron actually walked through the feasts a while back, so I'm not going to actually reinvent that wheel. I'm no feast expert. I've really only ever done one of the feasts in detail, and that would be a Passover Seder. And we didn't even really do that right because we didn't stay up all night. We didn't dress. We didn't get ready and pack up and leave the next day. So I would not consider myself a feast expert. You notice one that's missing here? Actually, two feasts that are missing. Two Jewish feasts that are celebrated today that aren't in this. One, of course, is Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah it's not even a biblical feast, right? It's not. It's an intertestamental feast. It's in the period of the Maccabees when there was Antiochus Epiphanes had cut off oil for the lighting of the lampstand. And history says, or tradition says, that the lamp burned 8 days solid without any oil being added to it as a miracle until they could get oil smuggled in to get it lit. That's why the Feast of Hanukkah is an 8-day feast with lights. Most menorahs have 7, but a Hanukkah menorah has 8. It's not because they miscounted. It's because it was an 8 days of light. That's why it's called the Festival of Lights. That's what it's about. So that's Hanukkah. Jesus did celebrate Hanukkah. We know he did that. He went to the a feast day, so it was a big deal for him too. It's at Hanukkah, as the Hanukkah celebration is getting over, that Jesus stands at the temple and says, "I am the light of the world." That's not an accident. He's doing that on purpose. The other feast that the Jews celebrate today that is not a Levitical feast is Purim. Purim is instituted in Esther, in the Persian time period. Purim celebrates or commemorates the deliverance of God's people from wicked Haman. And if that would be a fun one to go with Jewish people and celebrate. I would love to go celebrate Purim once with a group of Jews because it's a fun feast. They make fun of Haman. They have noisemakers. They scream him down. It's like if you've ever been to a melodrama, it is the Jewish melodrama where Haman is the villain, you know. And the melodrama is like the Miss Penelope thing tried to the railroad tracks and you have the hero. Well, of course, you know, they get the hero wrong. They get the wrong hero in Israel. They call Mordecai the hero. Listen to the sermon series I preached on that. You'll figure he's not. I believe Jesus also celebrated Purim. Some would say, no, it's never recorded that he celebrated Purim. But in John 5, he celebrates a feast, and the feast that they're celebrating is on is on the Sabbath. The only feast, and if you look at the 3 years of when he would be doing ministry, the only feast that would have happened while he was on a Sabbath would have been Purim. That's the only one that would have happened that way. So I believe he celebrated Purim as well. I could make that case, and I don't want to do it in like 20 seconds. So those are the feasts, and that's why those two, if you were curious, why isn't Hanukkah mentioned, why isn't Purim mentioned? That's why they're not Levitical feasts. They're not based in the law. So if you didn't keep Purim, if you don't keep Hanukkah, you're not a bad Jew. You're not violating the law because they're not Levitical or law-bound feasts. So there you have it. We flew through there. So what's the point? What's the idea? What's the big deal? The big deal so far is two things. First of all, worship God the way he wants to be worshipped, and worship happens all the time. And give your best. You know, we sing a song, give of your best to the master. Don't let that just be a song. Let's give him our best in everything we do. Paul quotes that, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. That's what we ought to be doing. That ought to define our life, is we're living for the glory of God in everything we say and everything we do. All right? Let me pray and then let you guys go. Lord, thank you for the time together this morning. Thank you for the truth in your word. I know we screamed through some stuff today, God, but I pray you'd help us to get the big idea. The big idea is let us worship you in spirit, truth, and completely with all of ourselves. We ask this in your name. Amen. Thanks. You're dismissed.